not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this April 29th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and it is our semi-annual fund drive. We come to you two times a year. Nicole Nelson is here in studio with me. She is going to be taking your calls for the next hour, and so happy to have you. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning, Marie.
Good morning. So we are here for the next hour, and we're here for the next 10 days, coming to you as we do twice a year, giving you the opportunity to give back to us. We bring you commercial-free programming. We've been doing it for 17 years. And with pleasure and gratitude, we do it every single week on an all-volunteer basis. And now is your time to give back to us, to give us a call and say thank you.
And that number is 949-824-5824, which is 949-UCI-KUCI. And Marie, I wanted to add that talking to people, I think some people think that the university funds the radio station, which it does in part, but there's a gap. And we have a goal, this fund drive, for a $10,000 amount total. And so if you could call now at 949-824-5824 and support the show, support the station, it would help us out a lot. Thank you.
For your $35 donation, we have CDs, gift certificates, copies of books. I have Aline Ohanessian's book, a signed copy from last week, and we have copies of her press posters that the publisher did a beautiful job putting those out. So we have that. We have books from past shows, past guests that we're able to give away. And so it's a great opportunity for you to express your gratitude for the show. I've heard that this show has functioned as an MFA for an at-home MFA program for some of our listeners, which is fantastic. I love hearing that. And give us a call, 949-824-5824. Tawny offered something in the last hour I was on with her that she would match a donation, and I'm willing to do that as well, of an $88.9 donation, $88.90. If you call and donate at that amount, I will match your donation. But we certainly have a goal this hour of $200. And so we hope to hear from listeners. PJ Colombo called in and donated $100 in the last hour, and so appreciate that. And anyway, we're going to do some more pitching at the bottom of the hour and towards the end of the show to tell you what this station has meant to both Nicole and to me. And but in the course of the hour, please give us a call, 949-824-5824. Nicole loves to hear your voice. Onward with the show. It is my pleasure this morning to welcome Michael Paterniti and Marian Palaya to the show this morning. Michael is with me now. Marian will join me for the second half of the show, and I am just wild for Michael's book of essays. He is a journalist, an essayist, and the best-selling author of Driving Mr. Albert and The Telling Room, the latter named one of the best books of the year by NPR, Entertainment Weekly, and the Christian Science Monitor. Nominated 8 times for the National Magazine Award, he is also the recipient of the NEA grant and 2 McDowell Fellowships. His stories have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, Harper's, Outside, Esquire, and GQ, where he works as a correspondent. He is the co-founder of a children's storytelling center in Portland, Maine, where he lives. His latest book of essays is Love and Other Ways of Dying. It's published by Dial Press, which is a division of Random House, and I am crazy for this book. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Every single essay was better than everyone before it. So I'm going to give you a chance to introduce the book. There's 17 essays, and just sort of talk about how the book came together, how these 17 essays came together, and some of the things you were thinking about in assembling it to bring our listeners sort of into this world.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I have to say, it was a very strange process to go back over 17 years of this career of sort of writing for magazines and writing long form features and essays and sorting through, you know, basically the wreckage of all these stories that I'd done, trying to figure out which ones to bring to the collection, which ones might hold together. And also to begin asking, I guess the question that one has to ask when they put together a collection is like, what is the point of all this? Like, what have I been doing? What am I looking for? So these essays range from, I mean, I call them essays. I mean, they're essay stories. They're hybrids. In some cases, they're purely narrative. In some cases, they're deeper meditations. So I think of them as a real mix, you know, from story to story, even the points of view shift. You know, we go from omniscient voices to first person to second person. So there's a lot of movement in the pieces, but they really range from, I guess I would call some of the aftermath, sort of the disaster aftermath stories that include reporting, writing about a plane crash that took place at Peggy's Cove, Nova Scotia, back in the late 90s. And there's a short piece in the aftermath of it describes the Haiti earthquake and the journey of one man in search of his daughters that day in Port-au-Prince. And then there's a different version of story in here where I guess I sort of am attracted to outsiders and I don't know, people that have been more marginalized, I guess, in society. So I visit with a giant in the Ukraine who was allegedly at the time the world's tallest man, who at 8'6" was still growing. You know, he was 33 years old when I went to see him, living in this tiny hovel with his mother, who was actually tiny. And he was just an amazing, gentle guy who was still growing out of his shoes and growing out of his clothes. There's another piece where I spend time at the Charles de Gaulle Airport with a man who basically had been living in Terminal 1 there for 15 years. So it's just this sort of wild assortment of people, places, events, and then underlying all of it is this sort of personal quest, I guess, that I've been on here since the beginning of my career to get closer to some of the bigger questions that consume me and that make up this life we lead.
Right, right. I started calling you an emotional tornado chaser. You look for the eye of the emotional storm and chase after it. And what a great way to lead a life, I think. Very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting. It's funny, like, I've always thought in music, the whole emo movement was like, kind of became this thing where people were, you know, much more interested in writing in lyrics that sort of went to deeper places for better or worse. And I don't know if it is emo journalism or what version of that this is, but I definitely have you know, spent a career attracted to people and places where some of these emotions are most evident. And so sometimes a story does form around that idea, you know, say in the case of the plane crash piece. It's really, really a granular sort of investigation of what grief looks like and feels like. And then in other cases, I think those emotions come out, you know, in the reporting. You find yourself in a faraway place and discover something or see something or feel something you never imagined you might. And so, for instance, in the case of one of the stories, I went to Nanjing, China, where I went to a bridge. They call it a suicide bridge because at least once or twice a week, somebody leaps from this bridge in Nanjing to the Yangtze River below and takes their life. And I heard about this one man named Mr. Chen, who had made it his life's work to stand out on this bridge and try to keep people from jumping. And, you know, in that piece and that trip that I made, all sorts of things revealed themselves that I could have never predicted, you know. And so suddenly I was really lost in sort of an emotional maelstrom that wasn't necessarily what I thought would occur when I went there.
Right, right. And these are stories that you seek out. I mean, they're not assignments that you were sent on. They're things that you read about in the paper, read about elsewhere, and then you seek them out, right?
Yeah, there are a lot of them that happen that way. And then you know, you establish some nice partnerships with editors through the years, and so sometimes someone will bring something that they just think is a great story for you, which feels really like a gift when that happens. And that happened in the case of The Man Who Sailed His House, which is a piece in the collection about a man who was caught in the Japanese tsunami. A wave broke over his little village by the sea, destroying 100 homes, basically killing everybody who was left in the village, except somehow for him. He was driven underwater and popped up next to the roof of his house, was somehow able to get on top of it and was sucked back out to sea and was found 2 days later, 9 miles out to sea on the roof of his house, you know, near death, but somehow survived. That was a story that was given to me by, or passed to me, I think, by Mike Benoit and Donovan Hone, who were two editors I was working with at GQ. So some of those stories do come, a couple of those stories have come that way, but most of them are really just me trying to find people who I think are somehow metaphoric or somehow offer something more universal that in telling the story of their lives, we're really sort of beginning to tell the story of our own lives, or we're finding out something about ourselves that we didn't know before.
Right. And it occurred to me that you've been at this since you were a kid. We learned in the essay The Accident, which is an essay about a car accident that happened involving two high school friends of yours, a fatality. And through the course of that essay, we learned that you, I've never heard of this before, but you worked for an ambulance service for teenagers and would be sometimes the first responders on some of these accident scenes to help victims. I kept having this image in my head.
Yeah.
If I was in a car accident, if some 15 or 16-year-old showed up, I'd be like, "What? Send the adults."
that was sometimes the reaction we got. But it occurred to me
you've been doing this.
Really unusual.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say it occurred to me that you have been doing this job of journalism since you were working. I mean, it's been longer than a career. It's almost been a lifestyle.
Yeah, I think some of it is going back to that time. I'm trying to understand what it was that was actually happening. I think you're, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old, showing up at the scene of an accident or going into a house where, you know, somebody's been hurt and you're walking into some sort of domestic situation that you've never seen before. We were trained very much to do our jobs, but then you were left with all of these questions about what you were actually seeing. And I think those questions have persisted for me, and trying to understand and recreate some of that has definitely been my life's work. And I do think, you know, I do think in places of extremity, you find certain epiphanies that aren't otherwise available. So, yeah. You know, that happens sometimes in war zones, or it happens in pressurized moments, whether they be tsunamis or earthquakes or, you know, but a lot of those things that reveal themselves are part of our everyday. And I think that's what's most interesting to me, is how normalcy can so quickly tilt into something extreme and then tilts back again. And so, you know, you may come out of something or survive something to walk back into a very quotidian world that doesn't recognize your experience or your pain, and then trying to figure out how to live beyond that and find happiness and joy again. That's been a big sort of concern and topos for a lot of the writing that I've done.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Michael Paterniti. The book is Love and Other Ways of Dying. And you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll remind our listeners that it is our fund drive. Nicole is standing by to take your call, 949-824-5824. We're looking for your $35 donation. And with that, a plethora of premiums we can offer you. So the interesting thing about, well, there's so many interesting things about these essays, but I love the fact that you are almost always a part of the essays. You know, in a lot of journalistic reporting, the narrator is absent or, but you're wholly integrated into these, you know, kind of almost verging on memoir in the essays. I assume that's a style, but talk about how the pieces become so much stronger with your own inclusion in them, and if that was something that you gave a lot of thought to, or, you know, if that's a style that you played around with.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I feel like every new story or essay that you begin on, eventually, especially after the reporting, sort of sets its own rules. You know, you're left with your reporting, what you found out, your reading, your thinking. And in some of these stories, they need the completion maybe of the first person, you know, of my own personal sort of questing inside of the material. And then there are others, you know, in the case of The Man Who Sailed His House, where I spent 4 or 5 days with this man who had survived. He'd lost his wife when the wave hit. And he was very reticent to tell his story, you know, but on the last day, as we took a train back from this decimated village to Tokyo where he'd been transplanted, he began to tell the whole story, you know, despite all the cultural prohibitions and the fact that he didn't want to single himself out, he didn't want to show any of his own grief. He let it all spill out. And in the case of that story, I just felt like, you know, it was his story. I very much didn't belong in that story. It was a story that I was almost telling back to him because the way he had told it to me was so fragmented because he was still trying to make sense of it. What had happened to him and the loss of his wife and how he had somehow survived, which was its own unbelievable story. So in that case, you know, I just kind of realized that there was not going to be an I. Whereas in a piece like, you know, maybe going to see Leonid Stebnik, the Giants in the Ukraine, I think you have to do some explaining, like why make such a trip and explain exactly what it is you think you might be after. I think the first person is it's a very sort of a tricky thing for me when I think about it. I'd like to be in there as little as possible, but just enough to create the guide wires to sort of guide a reader through and into the bigger ideas and surprises inside of these pieces.
Right, right. One essay that I'll thank you for in particular is El Bulli. I'm a huge foodie, and it had always been on my bucket list to make my way to that restaurant, which isn't going to happen now. But I felt like I sort of got a chance through your incredible writing and through your passion for the food and through his passion for the food that I got a little slice of the experience that I wasn't able to have in real life. And I'm eternally jealous. So that's all I'll say about it.
Oh, my God. I feel very lucky to have had that time, you know, with Ferran in that moment before, in fact, he'd become this sort of huge global phenomenon that he now is. But when he was still in just the complete crazy sparkling moment of creation where he was just obsessed with how he could destroy cuisine as we know it to remake this other kind of food. And it started with these, you know, foams where he would create a, it's just like basically you would find on the top of like a wave coming off the ocean, like this foam, the consistency of that, and somehow infusing it with like asparagus or whatever he just, or beets, you know, he would make these foams taste like anything he wanted. And soon, you know, the whole world was copying this, but the minute Ferran had created the foam, he, you know, he sort of turned his back on it and went on to try to create more. And yeah, it was an incredibly sensual experience to get to eat that food with him and to learn from him. But it was also, I mean, you know, it was really an attempt to try to understand too what creativity looks like up close, what that sort of protean act of creation looks like, and then also try to understand how happiness and joy come from or derive from a meal that's served before you in on the coast of Catalonia, you know, on some beautiful summer night. How you come to maybe the one of those happiest points in your life, you know, however fleeting.
The other thing about that essay was the positioning of the essay in the book. The ordering of the essays, I thought, told sort of an orchestral musical number where you were hitting a lot of different emotional notes in rapid succession. So we came off the plane crash in Nova Scotia, the sort of the devastation and lasting grief of that. And just, you know, when you feel very heavy, you enter into El Bulli, where it's just this fully sensual, happy experience. And then you're off to the fairy tale of the, well, I think it's the eating Jack Hooker's cow next. But you sort of take us on this long emotional ride through the ordering of the essays. And I assume a lot of thought went into that as well.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of thought went into some of the what we selected. You know, Andy Ward, who at one point was my one of my magazine editors, and is sort of the renowned Random House editor now, who happens to be my book editor. You know, he and I talked a lot about what pieces we were going to use. I mean, I think there's another collection that exists behind this that would be much funnier. You know, there's in a lot of what I try to do, you know, I'm also looking for the high and the low working at the same time. So I think I love using humor. I love being in humorous situations. But also, you know, I think like the ordering of these pieces was just an attempt to really early on set a mood that there was going to be an octave played, hopefully, throughout this book, that there were going to be pieces that had their own idiosyncratic kind of reason for being, that would include humor and beauty, even in the face of some of these death moments. And so, yeah, I really was hoping that, also just as a reader, I think you need to bog hop your way through some of the material. So I want people to read about, say, the Cambodian genocide. I think that's a really important piece. But I think if you've read five Cambodian genocide pieces before you get there, you're really going to close down at some point. There's there's got to be some pleasure and entertainment and the act of reading. And so as a writer, your job is to provide that as well. And so I'm glad you point that out, and I do hope that the ordering, you know, gives people an experience of feeling something fresh, you know, with each new page turned.
Right, and even the length of some of the essays. There's a very short piece on Columbine, and a relatively short piece on the Haiti earthquake. And even the length sort of gives you some, you know, breadth and movement between the essays, where they're not all, you know, 30, 35 pages. But that was nice.
Yeah. I think, and in some cases too, I remember the Columbine piece in particular. I was on assignment doing another story that appears in the book about my childhood hero, this Yankee catcher named Thurman Munson. So he had died as a kid in a plane crash, and I went back and sort of wrote this elegy for him, and visited all the old Yankees and hung out at Yankee Stadium with the new Yankees. But I was in Ohio at the time, visiting with Thurman Munson's wife on the day the Columbine took place, the Columbine shooting, and I had a call from my editor at the time, the editor-in-chief at Esquire, David Granger, And he just said, can you get out there and can you do something? And I said, yeah, I can leave right now. I can be there as soon as, you know, I can get there. I'm going. But what do you want? You know, how much do you need? And he said, if you have 10,000 words, you know, give me 10,000 words. If you have 800 words, give me 800 words. He's like, just tell me, just give me what you're feeling and give me the best possible, original, take on it. And so what came out was this very short, piece, you know, and I think in some ways it really said everything I wanted to say about it. It felt like this incredible changing moment in America. I mean, I think it's hard to remember those years before 9/11. I mean, we were in this sort of suspended state, kind of stuck between maybe two epochs or something. It felt that way. And when this shooting occurred, it almost felt like the manifestation of some strange evil, you know, and it really, for me, in some ways, marks the beginning of this change, of this sort of more apparent, more conscious violence that has become part of our world. And you know, it's always been there, but just in terms of the way I sort of see the world and having been there in the aftermath of that shooting, it felt like we had entered a new era somehow, right. And that some former innocence had been lost on that day.
Right, right. Sadly, we're drawing down on our time, and I could talk to you for 100 years. But I also wanted to touch on, you had said, and these essays really convey it, that you're always looking off to the side to see what's happening in the margin or see what's happening behind somebody. And I was hoping in your last words here, if you could sort of share, when you go into a story, where your focus is, what you're looking for, what details you're picking out to bring these stories so vividly to life.
You know, in some ways, I go in just as like a human being. I just go in. I go in amazed. I begin from that place, and I'm always looking for, I don't know, just the beauty in everyday life and everyday people. I mean, that's much more interesting to me than having lunch with a celebrity, you know, out in Hollywood. And so I think what I'm looking for is just those little gestures of. To maybe the little exchange between the mother and the giant son, where you realize that, you know, she's made him lunch as if he were a 12-year-old boy, because this is a man who can't go out. You know, he doesn't go to restaurants. He doesn't have a society of any sort. He's a complete loner. And in these sort of gestures and these moments, you know, all these sort of beautiful things open up, and that's really what I'm chasing. And so, yeah, when I walk into a room, I'm beginning a conversation, but I'm really looking for the story underneath it, and what the words are really saying, even when we're talking about sort of the most normal things, and it's been all-consuming, you know, and every time I go out, I just feel that total rush of energy, thinking that I may find it again. I may find something, you know, incredible, something beautiful, something amazing, something potentially tragic that makes and heightens all of these other things, and that's really the stuff of our life.
Michael Paternity, this was a huge pleasure. The best thing you said this whole half hour is that there's another book coming behind this, so I am a huge fan. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you, Marie. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure. The book is Love and Other Ways of Dying. That was Michael Paternity. You can find it. I am, like I said, it's just one great, great essay after the next. I am going to put Nicole on. She's going to give us reasons why you should donate, reasons why you should give us a call at 949-824-5824. I'm going to get Marion on the line. And Nicole's going to bring us some updates. Nicole, hi.
Hi there. So it's a little quiet out there in the lobby, so I wanted to check in with our listeners. And we hear from you. We know that you appreciate the programming. So KUCI is an FCC-licensed, non-commercial educational radio station. And that non-commercial part, so we come to you every week and we spend our volunteer time putting together podcasts and bringing the show to you and updates on Facebook and Twitter. And we really do our best to put together a quality broadcast. And without those commercials, it's really a treat. And so now's the chance for you to do your part and show us that you enjoy the show and that you value the material. That number is 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. Another point is that this is an all-volunteer staff, and the KUCI's current staff exceeds 120 volunteers, and including Barbara, Marie, and I. And not only are we volunteers, but we pay for our parking, and we pay for our phone calls, the phone call Marie is making right now to the next guest on her phone card, and so we're happy to do that, and we love the show, and we love the chance to talk to these authors and bring these conversations to you. But again, please show your support by calling now. It's 949-824-5824. We have some great pledge levels. For $35, is you become a member, and you have a premium that you're entitled to, and we can go over those with you. There are additional levels. A $50 donation will get you two premiums, and that's barely equal to $4 a month, only 14 cents a day. And if you feel extra generous, you can do pledge at the $100 level. And there are lots of great premiums available at that level, including one, which was taken advantage of already this fund drive, which is you can come in and sit in with any one of the three of us, your choice, and do a show with us, participate in that, and be a part of that in the studio. So, and I will also say that we really appreciate donations at any level. So if you aren't up for becoming a member at $35, we really appreciate your support. So that number, 949-824-5824. Thanks so much for listening, and we so appreciate your support.
Thanks so much, Nicole. We are back. We're back, Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. I'm listening to the phone, the sweet sound of the phone ringing outside. Again, I made the offer earlier in this hour that I will be matching your donation of $88.9, $88.90. If anybody donates at that level, I will match you, and I will be donating on my own anyway. But this station is, I am passionate about it. I'm going to talk about why at the end of the hour, but all of your donations, whatever you can give, are so appreciated. Onward with the show. Maria, I'm so sorry. Maria is on with me now, Maria Palea, and she received her BA from the Evergreen State College, her MA in Creative Writing from San Francisco State University, and her MFA from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her work has appeared in Tri-Quarterly and the Virginia Quarterly Review, and she has been a John Steinbeck Fellow and a San Jose State University. She lives in San Francisco and has lived, among other places, in Montana, Hong Kong, Ho Chi Minh City, and Nepal, where she was a Peace Corps volunteer. She has been a truck driver, a bartender, and a logger. I love it. The Given World is what we're talking about today. It is fantastic. It is her first novel. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's my pleasure to bring her on. Marian, hello.
Hello there. How are you?
I am well. I am always passionate about Vietnam. It's a war that touched our family fairly deeply, and anytime I get a chance to read about perspectives on Vietnam, about people, families, not the fighters who were affected by Vietnam, I am completely drawn in. So The Given World was right up my alley. Thank you for writing it.
Yeah, thanks for reading it.
with that introduction, I'm going to let you actually introduce the book, talk about The Given World, talk about Riley, where she came from, and this world of great characters and sort of how they came to be.
Okay. Riley was actually a character in a standalone short story that I wrote probably about 15 years ago. And it was just meant to be a story about this young woman who had lost her brother, and she ends up in Missoula working in a gas station and buys this old beater Mustang and just sort of drives around, and she's just a little off. And it was just that. And then she decides, of course, like all young women do, to go to San Francisco to work it all out. And then it just sort of sat. It was published in Passages North a long time ago, and then it was never meant to be anything more than that. And then when I ended up at Madison in 2010 and started writing stories for the workshops there, Riley just sort of reappeared, and she hadn't had a name up until that point. But then she got a name and a bigger story, and I wrote the Vietnam chapter first, and then one of the San Francisco chapters. And I wrote the whole thing as short stories, because that's what you workshop in an MFA normally. And then went back and put it together as a novel, sort of put in the connecting material in between. So it was quite an adventure. It took me about 4 years.
Yeah, that process I was fascinated by, because, you know, short stories have such a different feel than novels. And I thought, oh, my gosh, right. This poor woman had to.
It's, you know, it was hard. Aligning it as a novel was hard, because it had never really even occurred to me to write a novel. But then it began to look like one, sort of. And so I really had to teach myself how to, I mean, of course, I had a lot of great help at Madison, but, you know, after that was over and I was kind of on my own, and then just figuring out how to get the momentum in there and, you know, draw a reader through 250 pages rather than just through 20 pages is, you know, it's a lot bigger task. But I learned so much doing it, and I really loved doing it, so it wasn't really, you know, there were bad days, but for the most part I just really enjoyed doing it.
Did you completely deconstruct the short stories and sort of take the ideas from them and start from scratch, or did you really try to use the
material? I didn't, and you know, many of the chapters in there, to me, you know, still could just stand alone as short stories, with maybe just a little bit of, you know, with the addition of maybe just a little bit of backstory in them. And I've been writing short stories. I mean, I haven't written them in a long time now, but I have been writing short stories for 20, 25 years by the time I wrote this novel. So that's pretty firmly embedded in me, you know, that short story arc.
Right.
And I don't have a problem with the chapters in a novel, anybody's novel, having that sort of, you know, beginning, middle, and end arc. So
right,
it's kind of a hybrid,
right?
It's a hybrid thing.
you had the lucky experience of working with one of my literary heroes, Laurie Moore, who I just am wild for her short stories. Talk a little bit about that experience, her mentorship, what was learned during that relationship.
You know, it's funny that I was out with, I'm in Madison right now, and this is the first time I've been back. I did a reading last night, and I went out with people that were in my cohort, you know, and other writers that I met here, and it was just so awesome to see everybody. But we were talking about the first night of class, because it was the first semester that we were all here, and Laurie was our first workshop teacher, and we were so nervous, and we were all in the little MFA office going, you know, all the rumors. Oh, she's really mean. Oh, she likes the boys better than she likes the girls. You know, if you don't use all six senses on every page, you'll fail the class.
Good Lord.
So Lori's a very, you know, I don't know if she's shy. I mean, she's a pretty private person, which is understandable because, you know, everywhere she goes, she gets swarmed. But so, you know, we had nothing to go on but rumor. So anyway, we went to class, and she showed up with two bags, you know, of, like, brownies and stuff from Trader Joe's and cloth napkins. And she was just so sweet and generous she was just lovely. And she really, I mean, I loved her. One of the reasons I came to Madison is because she was here. And I've always loved her work. But then to meet her as, you know, as a person and realize just, she's just generous is just the word that really that comes to me. She's just very, very generous and, of course, a great reader.
Yes. And she's the one who told you to turn these into a novel, yes?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, she gave me permission to, more than anything. I mean, because, you know, you always hear as a writer, like, novels are more marketable than short story collections. And you know, since the characters kept recurring, I was like, well, maybe it's time to attempt to do something like this. But what she really, the most important thing I got from her was she read a very early draft of the Vietnam section, and she said, and I sort of gave it a soft landing. It was very short. It was sort of an assignment on what it means to be an American that she gave us, and it had, you know, there was Fung and she was pregnant, and it ended up with sort of a soft landing. And what she said was, You put the stake in, but then you took it out. And she said, "See what would happen if you left it in." And it just changed everything for me. And I just realized that, you know, what she was saying essentially was, you have to write things that hurt. You know, you have to write the hard stuff, and you're ready to write the hard stuff, which I was. So it changed the whole dynamic of pretty much everything I'll ever write again, probably. So.
With one sentence.
Great.
I love that when somebody comes in and clarifies what you're...
You know, it happens. It just, you know, with mentors. I've had a few other people in my long history of writing who have come along just at the right time and, you know, just said just the right thing at the right time. And it's like, okay, now it's my job to take that and run with it. So, yeah. Well, I mean, working with her was a gift, but working with everybody at Madison was really incredible.
It was a gift, yeah. So let's talk about some of these characters and how they started to emerge in your head, how you got to know them. We've talked with authors who said they got to know their character by some smell that they passed by one day. They couldn't access their character, so they smelled something. And all of these characters are so quirky and wounded and wonderful. And so I wanted to get inside your process of getting to know these people and who gave you the biggest problems and who you fell in love with the most, kind of your process of getting to know these people.
Well, for the most part, they're amalgamations of people that I've actually encountered or known pretty well. And two of them... especially, Lou and Cole were real, you know, thinly disguised real people, and I can write about them the way that I do because they've both died since of just bad living, since I knew them, you know, when I was writing the book, because I had to talk to an attorney to make sure that I wasn't libeling anybody, and he said you can't libel the dead. But so those two were both the most difficult, just on an emotional level, people to write about, but also the easiest because they're so clear in my head. And it was such an amazing experience to be able to just really, it felt like spending time with them, you know, to really just let them inhabit my head for those, you know, for the time it took to write those pages. And that was really, I don't know, it's really wonderful. I think the character that was hardest for me to write was Frank. He kind of came in late, and I realized that I needed one more perspective of her. He also was, you know, very loosely based on somebody that I knew when I worked at the newspaper agency when I drove a truck. And I'm still not to this day sure if I quite got him right. But But the characters, and Daryl was, you know, there was a boy I was in love with many years ago who was a lot like Daryl, but, you know, I really, that part of the story was pretty much made up out of whole cloth. And but it was also kind of really easy to write. I don't know why, you know, it was his voice in my head or what, you know, where that came from. It's all these people just started with, you know, a line or an image or something, and then they just sort of rambled on. I don't know. It's a very magical thing.
That's a gift.
They say, you know, I've read writers who say that's not true. You know, that doesn't really happen. But in my world, it does happen. So
Yeah. Every writer has their own experience. My guest this morning is Maria Pilate. I'm destined to not say it right. And as I'm saying it, I'm like, I know I'm going to screw it up. Pilate.
It's okay.
No,
you are not the first.
I'm so embarrassed. And the book is The Given World. It is wonderful. You said one thing that I want to end on. I know you have a flight to catch, so I want to make sure that you have time for that. But I do want.
I've still got a little bit of time.
Okay, I do want to talk about this. So you were talking about revision. I know you're a revision horse, and you said raw. You know, and this book is so raw. Raw is hard to add back into a piece. It might even be impossible. But what I learned is that raw isn't enough. A collection of clever lines isn't enough. And I think that's where a lot of writers get stuck, that they think that this collection of great sentences is good, but it's not a story. And I was hoping you could talk about that, because I think you've lived through that this was very raw, and through the revision process, it became a novel. But it is easy to get caught up in that, falling in love with a raw sentence and I don't know, editing the magic out of it is always a sad thing.
Yeah, and not wanting to give it up. Yeah. I just, you know, the reason that I feel like it's okay for me to say those things in public is because I was that kind of a writer for many years, and I just, you know, I think some people do have an innate talent for words, you know, and a love of the language, so that, you know, that you think in beautiful sentences or in clever sentences or whatever. I think, you know, for some people that just comes naturally. But, you know, and for years I just parlayed that into, you know, whatever, straight A's in creative writing classes. And you know, and that kind of recognition, it was like, you know, wow, you know, a phenomenon or whatever. And then, but then I've realized that, and it took me a long time, but I sort of realized that I was essentially writing the same short story over and over again. You know, it was basically Montana punk cowgirl fiction, you know, and just bad girls in bars. And it was fun, and it was, you know, on some level impressive to some people, you know, impressive enough to get nominated for whatever, you know, get a few things published. But as I got older and started having more experiences out in the world, I realized that that was such a small part of it, and that, I don't know, that I guess I realized that if I'm going to write, I want what I write about to have some, you know, to resonate in a larger place than just me and my little world, you know. And so I'm teaching that at San Francisco State, and, you know, I'm trying to get that through to my students too, which is hard because they're young and they, you know, obviously haven't had the extra 30 years I've had to have all these experiences. But,
right,
you know, to at least pay attention to what's going on in the world and somehow try to connect to that, you know, not on a didactic level, but on an emotional level.
Exactly.
And just realize that your world is very small. That we're all connected somehow. I know this is starting to sound very, I don't know what.
Metaphysical.
But
no, it's true.
But yeah. I do tire. You know, there are many, you know, there are a lot of, I call it the Quentin Tarantino effect, actually, in classes, is that, you know, I believe that he is very, you know, very bright and very clever. But you know, to me, his movies all end at clever. Hmm. And I want, you know, and I want more than that. I want editing.
I like that.
I want you to go back and, you know, and make this all tie together and make sense. So I tell my students, like, don't go all Quentin Tarantino on me or you will fail this
school. And use all five senses on every page. I love it. I love it. Any last minute words of advice we haven't talked about?
It's funny. I always asked that question by a young man last night at the reading, and I think it's so complicated. But yes, go out and experience the world, and yes, do an MFA if you can. And if you can do an MFA, don't complain about it, because you are you're breathing very rarefied air if you actually get to do something like that. And I can't, of course, stop thinking about Nepal right now and comparing that to, a little bit of whining that you hear around English departments and going, okay.
Yeah, get a grip.
Your house didn't fall down on your head last night, so maybe a little perspective is in order.
Right, right.
But also learning to love revision. I think that is such a great, a lot of people don't like to do it, but I think if you can learn to love it, it adds so much. There's so much discovery in revision. So
I love it.
That's my words of wisdom.
Marian, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time. Where do we find
you too, Marie?
Where do we find you online and around so we can find you?
I have a website that is sort of it's floundering out there. It's marianpalaya.com. But actually, most of the information that's been gathered, interviews and links and stuff like that, is on my page at Simon & Schuster, and I don't have the URL, but it's simonandschuster.com, and then they've got their author link, and just go to P, and there I am, and they're very good about gathering all that stuff in one place. I'm very bad at it.
They are very good, and there's a great video on their website of you introducing the book, and
I was so nervous. That was my first trip to New York since the 70s, and I was so nervous that I was like, oh, I have to fly to New York tomorrow to meet my publisher, which, of course, is something I've always wanted to say.
What a great sentence. Yeah, right.
They are great. They were great. So anyway, and I have two Facebook pages. I have an author page and my own page, and I get very confused between the two of them, but I'm out there.
I love it. I love it. The Given World is the book. And thank you so much for taking the time this morning and safe flight back to San Francisco.
Thank you so much. And I can't wait to listen to this and see if I made any sense.
You made all the sense in the world. It was wonderful.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right.
I want to give a huge special thank you to Marie in Pennsylvania. First of all, you have a great name, but you donated. And speaking of MFA programs and their importance, Marie says that Writers on Writing has been her MFA program at home. And what a great thing that is. So Marie, thanks so much for your donation this morning. That means so much. Nicole is here with an update.
We're here answering phones, ready to take your call at 949-824-5824.
That's awesome. So we've gotten two great donations. PJ called and donated, and Marie from Pennsylvania called and donated. I love that our listeners are all over the place. They're not just in Orange County, but they're everywhere. And I wanted to share that I've been with the station for 9.5 years now doing this show. I sub on other shows occasionally, and KUCI has become part of my family. I feel like I've grown up here through my 30s and early 40s. My daughter has sort of grown up here. She's 13 and she's been running around the station since she was 4. It's been such a special environment for all of us. It's added so much to our lives. And this is your chance to show how it's added to your life, too. I know we have a lot of loyal listeners. We hear from them often and we appreciate them so much. And so if you have been on the show, if you've been a guest of the show, if you've been a loyal listener to the show, or if you've just learned about the show and are now tuning into us, we would love to hear from you. Any donation amount is welcome. $35 is what we ask for. $100 gets you a seat on the show, and PJ is going to come in and join us in studio on the show. We are more than happy to take your $100 donation and show you what we do here at the studio. Maybe you'll catch the bug and want a show of your own. That happened to a friend of ours. She has a food show now on Thursday mornings. Kelly does a great show on Home Plate on Thursday mornings. There's a plethora of great programming on this station. Music. Teddy is up next doing an amazing reggae show. We do public affairs shows from 8 to 10 every weekday morning and from 4 to 6 every weekday afternoon. And it's a labor of love. Have I missed anything? I probably have.
I think you covered it, Marie, the heart of it.
Well, I'm going to stick around. I'm going to stay for another hour or so that I can talk to you. So call me, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. And next week, are you up next week?
I am. We have Mary Norris. She's worked at The New Yorker for 30 years, starting as a assistant editor and working her way up. And now she has a book about language, and I can't wait to talk to her. We also have Christy Watson, Where Women Are Kings.
And I'm going to be here next week answering your phones. So
thank you for that, Marie.
So we're going to be here for the next 10 days. You can donate online if you choose to do that and you're scared to talk to us. We're not really scary, but if you'd like to do that, you can go onto our website, KUCI.org, and donate there. Be sure to mention, if you do that, be sure to mention our show, Writers on Writing. And so until next time, thanks so much for joining all of us. Have a great day and give us a call. Enjoy your week.